Fayetteville. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government. He's the communications director with news from the legislature and the latest on that chemical spill at the Formaggio cheese plant in Shelby yesterday. 16 people were hospitalized for chemical exposure. We'll get an update. The Stonewall Jukebox, a documentary concert about the most significant uprising in LGBTQ plus history. It's coming to the Tustin Theater in Narrowsburg, and creator David Driver is here to tell us more about this part jubilant musical performance, part little-known oral history concert. And culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks to artist Maya McLaughlin, whose works are full of magic, imagination, and whimsy. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Three Americans are now in Texas after being released as part of a multinational prisoner exchange. The trio includes Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich. Their first stop last night on American soil was at Joint Base Andrews in suburban Washington, D.C. NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports they were greeted by President Biden and Vice President Harris.
Stepping down onto the tarmac late Thursday evening, Gershkovich stretched out his arms, first to hug Vice President Kamala Harris, then President Biden, and finally his mother, who he lifted off the ground in excitement as they embraced for the first time in more than a year. Two other freed American prisoners, including former U.S. Marine Whelan and journalist Alsu Kermasheva, were also greeted on the tarmac. In total, 16 people were freed from Russia in the deal. They include Americans, Russian dissidents, and German prisoners. Eight Russians were returned to the Kremlin in exchange. They included undercover spies and a convicted FSB assassin. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News.
The leader of the political wing of Hamas has been buried in Qatar. Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated on Wednesday during a visit to Iran's capital. Iran blames Israel, but Israel has not confirmed or denied it was behind Haniyeh's slaying. Vice President Harris's presidential campaign says it raised more than $310 million during the month of July. NPR Stephen Fowler reports that is a record campaign haul.
The Harris campaign brought in more than $200 million in the first week after she replaced Biden as the likely Democratic nominee, and the money kept coming. Two-thirds of the people who gave money last month were first-time donors. Trump's campaign reported bringing in nearly $140 million in July, a near record for him, too. Both campaigns are sitting on hundreds of millions in the bank as they gear up for the last 3 months of the 2024 campaign. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
Stocks opened lower this morning after a weaker-than-expected jobs report. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled about 440 points in early trading.
U.S. employers added just 114,000 jobs last month, a marked slowdown from the average over the last year, and fewer than most forecasters were expecting. The unemployment rate rose to 4.3% as more than 400,000 people joined or rejoined the workforce. The weaker-than-expected jobs news follows a disappointing report on the factory sector Thursday, which also triggered a stock market sell-off. The Federal Reserve said this week it's watching the job market for signs of weakness after a long period in which the central bank was primarily concerned with fighting inflation. With price hikes cooling, the Fed is widely expected to start cutting interest rates at its next meeting in September. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down more than 1%. The Nasdaq is down 2.5%. This is NPR. Heat waves across much of the U.S. likely happen because of climate change, according to scientists. NPR's Jeff Brady reports that today, nearly half of the country will experience high temperatures that were three times more likely to occur because of a warming planet.
Extreme heat from the Rocky Mountains to the East Coast are expected to spread across much of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico through next week, according to the nonprofit Climate Central. The Union of Concerned Scientists says fossil fuel-driven climate change has increased the frequency and severity of heat waves. That puts elderly people, children, and those with health conditions at particular risk of heat-related illnesses. The group World Weather Attribution also found that heat affecting the Olympics, large parts of Europe, and North Africa would have been impossible without human-caused climate change. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen has declared a state of emergency for the central and eastern parts of his state. These were blasted Wednesday night by powerful storms. The tracking site, poweroutage.us, says nearly 100,000 Nebraska customers still don't have power back, most of them around Omaha. Blackouts briefly affected the water supply for the city of Lincoln, but power has since been restored to Lincoln's wells. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has put much of his state under emergency ahead of a strong storm system moving north. This could become a tropical storm. Forecasters warn some areas of southern Florida could get drenched. Up to 5 inches of rain could fall across South Florida. Some areas may get more. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Friday, and that means we check in with Dan Hoos, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, bringing us news from the legislature, but also bringing us some news about a chemical spill at the Formaggio cheese plant just down the road from us here in Loch Sheldrick. Folks were hospitalized. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, yesterday around 10 a.m., our 911 center, I think, took a call from Formaggio Cheese, which is a they make wonderful cheese. It's a factory over in Loch Sheldrick, just off of Route 52. And from what we could piece together, there apparently was a mixing of some cleaning chemicals that created some odors that sickened people. And, of course, not knowing exactly what had been mixed and whether those odors were life-threatening or merely nausea-inducing and irritant kind of thing, we evacuated the plant. All 330 workers were told, got to go. The owner, very actually great owners, made sure that they had an air-conditioned bus brought in for them to sit in because it wasn't sure how long it was going to be before they could reopen. Thankfully, they did in the afternoon. However, 16 people had to be hospitalized because they were complaining of nausea and sweat and itchiness and red-faced. They were presenting indications that they had been exposed to some sort of chemical that was not agreeing with them. I am happy to say all 16 have been released from the hospital and are not suffering any further effects. We aren't yet certain exactly what chemicals were involved, although I think the owner was quoted as saying there was some acetone involved. It was not part of the manufacturing of the cheese. They don't manufacture with caustic toxic chemicals. This was to clean, I believe, floor spaces, which of course, you want them to be as clean as possible in a food production facility. So it was one of those situations that thankfully did not get worse. The factory is back open. But it was a good chance for our folks to practice in a hazardous material situation, a chemical spill, which doesn't happen that often. But when it does, we want to be sure that we're taking all the appropriate steps. And thankfully, with the collaboration of police agencies, fire departments, our volunteer ambulance corps, and a paid corps, too, I think, was involved, we made sure that it didn't get worse than it could have been.
Yeah, the Loch Sheldrick Fire Department was dispatched, Liberty Fire Department involved, mm-hmm. Town of Fallsburg Police, Sullivan County Bureau of Fire, Sullivan County Bureau of EMS, and Sullivan County Sheriff's Office. Rick Pagan, the senior vice president of the Formaggio plant, told MidHudsonNews.com that, quote, "We are under construction. They were cleaning the floors with acetone in a separate part of the building. We're not sure if that made it into the ventilation system." He went on to say that it's a good possibility as to what happened, and they're concerned with the safety of their employees. So I take it they're monitoring the air quality now.
Mm-hmm. We continue to monitor, but I think if there had been a concern that it would spread beyond the plant, we would have issued evacuation orders for the areas around the plant as well, and that's not the case. I think whatever it was confined to the facility itself, and they're continuing to monitor, but at this point it seems like things are back to normal. So,
meanwhile, the legislature meeting, as normal, on Thursdays. What was coming out of the legislature's meeting yesterday? They started talking about those staggered terms again.
Yeah, this is the big thing that came. I think we're getting farther now than any past legislature has, because, as was mentioned, the Charter Review Commission, which meets every 10 years, has recommended this every time that it is finished meeting. And before I get into the staggered terms, let me just explain. The Charter Review Commission is mandated by the Charter, which is the county's, if you will, constitution. And it was created when we shifted to a legislative form of government from the Board of Supervisors back in the mid-1990s. So that charter gives basically structure to county government, and one of its main things is that a group of people selected by the legislature need to come together every 10 years and take a look at the charter and say, is it working? Is it not working? If something we think could be improved upon, what is that? And then they make recommendations to the legislature. And the past two sets of charter review commissions have made a recommendation to consider staggered terms. They've also made a recommendation to consider a county executive. But for both situations, actually, there really hasn't been interest by the legislature. There still really isn't by the majority of legislators for county executive, although I think that'll continue to be talked about in the years to come. This legislature definitely wants to discuss that further. But what they are getting close to now is the staggered terms, which probably will come up for a vote in front of the public this November during the general election. That's what this is moving towards. What it would require, of course, is first for the legislature to pass a law saying we want to put this in front of voters, staggered terms. Hopefully by the time it gets in front of voters, we'll actually have an idea of what those terms would look like, but that actually isn't technically necessary for this to be put in front of voters. However, I think the one option I think that most of them are looking towards is to have upon the next election of legislators, which is about 3 years away, would have three legislators run for two-year terms, three legislators run for three-year terms, and three legislators run for four-year terms. Currently, all nine run for four-year terms, and the concern is that since they all come up for election at the same time, that they could all be replaced, and you would have a brand new, completely brand new legislature with no institutional continuation of knowledge.
Well, a little bit of that happened this year with not everybody, but a large chunk of that legislature. There were some new folks, new faces.
Yeah, actually, most of the past legislative elections have included a majority new legislators for over the past decade.
And it does take a little while for them to get up to speed and to sort of, you know, understand. And
yep. Usually, having covered legislature and also now working very closely, though, my estimation has been takes about 3 months for them to get their initial feet underneath them. About 6 months to understand all that's going on with the county and sort of have a better grip on what they're doing as legislators, and then probably a full year to truly have that deep knowledge that you need to well represent people. And listen, that is an inevitability. We can't not elect new legislators because we're afraid it's going to take them a long time to get up to speed. But the idea is that if we could be assured of having some legislators who have already gotten that experience to help guide the new ones through, that's better serving the taxpayers. And it seems the legislators all agree on that and now want to put it in front of the public to see if they agree on that. Because if the public says, no, we like it the way it is, then it doesn't go any farther.
Is there anything else from the Charter Review Commission that they're looking at?
Only the county executive, which, again, there doesn't seem to be a majority interested in going down that. They continue to discuss it. However, the Charter Review Commission is up to meet again. We're now at that 10-year point. It usually, since the first legislature was created in 1995, every 10 years, so we're coming up on 2025, so it's time for the legislature to begin to solicit new Charter Review Commission members and have them meet again. And sometimes it takes just a few months. Sometimes it takes a couple of years for them to come back with recommendations, but it's required by the charter, and we're getting pretty close to that point. So expect to see probably a press release from me at some point inviting people to apply to be on the Charter Review Commission.
You mentioned that the staggered terms might be a ballot measure that goes into this year's election. What's the deadline for that and got to get onto the ballot?
September. We have to have it ready for the Board of Elections so that they can put it on the ballot. I think the chances are very good that that's going to happen this year, which again will be farther than any legislature has gotten, because in the past legislators have been understandably uncomfortable with who gets the short end of the stick. You start thinking, okay, I'm going to run for 4 years, for a 4-year term, but maybe you're going to be one of those that might run for re-election now for a 2-year term or a 3-year term and then have to run again. But there's no way really around that. You have to stagger out the terms, and somebody's going to draw the short straw. And that actually may be what they do. They may actually draw straws, which if that happens, I hope to be there to video record that, because I think that would be fascinating to see. So either that or a Hollywood Squares-like setup where I'm the MC. That'd be fun.
I see which one you're leaning toward, though. If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday for an update from the legislature in Monticello and other county news. Also, the legislature yesterday debating the room tax allocation. Let's remind folks about the room tax. It's an important part of the revenue stream here in
yes,
county.
Yes, it is. And it's been increasing. It's many, many millions of dollars. I don't know what it is currently at the moment, but it's, I think, more than it's ever been before. In years past, the Tourism Promotion Agency for the county, Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, has gotten 85% of that revenue. And by law, by state law, they can get up to 85%. And we can claim up to 15% on the county for administrative costs. Usually goes to the treasurer's office for what they have to do to keep track of all that room tax, because that's our job, not the SCVA's job. However, the past legislature and now also this legislature has continued to talk about possibly splitting up some of that 85% with other nonprofit tourism promotion agencies in the county. It depends on how you read the state law. Some read it to say it's only one nonprofit agency. And of course, the argument can be made that that's a lot more, a lot easier to track and more efficient. But then there are other legislators who are saying, no, it can be split up amongst multiple nonprofit tourism promotion agencies, of which there are others in the county.
So the one I know of is the Sullivan County Visitors Association.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what are the others?
There's also the Delaware Company, which happens to run Fort Delaware and Menasink Battleground Park for us. There's also the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway. And it could even be expanded beyond that based on what you consider the definition of a tourism promotion nonprofit to be. So there has been talk not about abandoning the relationship with the SCVA. The SCVA would continue to get the bulk of the funds. But there are some funds, I think it's about $2 million right now, that are still sort of in limbo, that have not been provided to the SCVA. And legislators are like, well, do we give it to the SCVA or do we keep it and give it to another company to do work that is supplementary to, not competitive with the SCVA. Obviously, the Visitors Association is making a case and continued to make one yesterday that they have a great track record and can do this better than anybody else can, and it just makes sense to invest that with them. But there are other legislators who are like, I'd like to see what else is out there and maybe do a few things that either the SCVA can't or wouldn't do, or maybe is something in somebody else's wheelhouse for that. So it can get a bit contentious, that debate, and it did yesterday a little bit. And I think it will continue to be so because no resolution was made. There was resolution put forward, but it wasn't voted on about that. But there weren't enough votes. They didn't even bother to have the vote because there weren't enough on the committee there.
But what was the resolution?
The resolution was to go forward.
It out.
To spread it out, or at least put that ability explicitly into the law of or the local law of what we're doing. Because state law, it's not explicit. It says tourism nonprofit promotion agency. And the question is, does that mean a single agency or can it be split amongst other agencies? And at this point, it seems some legislators are looking at that as it can be split up. So whether or not that actually is going to happen, stay tuned.
Is there a deadline for allocation of those funds?
No. No, these have been sort of hanging out since the last legislature, so they could continue to be in limbo for quite a while.
Mm.
Obviously, they are gaining interest. We've invested them. So I think at some point those monies will find a use. The question is for who and how much, because too, it also could be a percentage of those funds in limbo, as I'm saying. It might not be all 100% of those that go to a particular thing. And really, there's also the argument between legislators of, is this micromanaging like the SCVA, or is this, since it's a contract, vendor client relationship, like, you know, they're our contracted vendor, are we within our rights as a legislature to say, listen, this is what we want you to do with this particular pot of money? So as you could tell, it involves money and control, and that can get contentious anywhere.
Are there specific ideas about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been ideas about promoting more specifically tourism events rather than just the overall experience. I think the SCVA would like to return to advertising in New York City in the Times Square area, which costs a lot of money. And they haven't really been able to do of late. My understanding is, like, you know, on one of those big Times Square billboards. Pretty cool to see that when you're down there. I have had a chance to see that before. So it's a question of where that funding should go. Who should get it, and what should they
do? Who has control of it? And mm-hmm. I think there was an argument to be made, though, that it should come to a resolution more quickly, just because it would benefit everyone.
Yeah.
Right. Rather than have the money in limbo, you're putting it to use in whatever way that is, come to a resolution
that
sooner rather than later.
Been hanging out there as long as the money's been hanging out there. Yes. So
I'm no brainiac, Dan. No. But
this is why I encourage people to watch what goes on with the legislature, because this could be quite fascinating to see. Yesterday's discussion about it, I think, is worth people taking a look at. And you might come down on one side or the other. I'm not taking sides here. It's not my role to do so, but to explain what legislators are thinking, that's what I hope people find interesting about what I'm telling them, is that there are at least two sides to this story.
Yeah.
And maybe three if you count the SCVA part of it as well.
Well, not taking sides either, but just advocating for the resolution so that this money that's there can be put to good use. Right?
I think everybody would like to have that resolution, but for various reasons, it has yet to arrive.
Let's rest our brains for a second. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with more. Dan Hoost from the Sullivan County Government. After this, this is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Can two people with different political beliefs still have a meaningful conversation? I'm Ronald Kelson, and I'm working with Radio Catskill on StoryCorps' One Small Step, bringing strangers and our community together, one conversation at a time. We are having conversations in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania all year long, and you should be a part of it. Sign up now at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're with Dan Hoost. He is the Sullivan County Government Communications Director and joins us every Friday. More news from the county government. The Youth Bureau has funding available. I like how you said this, I think, on your press release about this, which was to need money for youth projects. Go to the Sullivan County government, apply here. Mm-hmm. So you got a pot of money for youth
got a lot
programs.
Of money. Yeah. Usually, at least $100,000 and oftentimes more than that, $200,000-$300,000. And we're still developing the budget for 2025, but that's what this money will be for. Because the money for 2024 is already being dispersed as we speak, but it's dozens of local groups. And we want to make sure that you're properly run, that this money is going to be properly spent. But other than that, we're not really tough on what we're going to give this money for. You just need to state your case as to what you want to do for the youth of Sullivan County. It's a great program. I'm proud to say that We fund every corner of the county. There are programs from Roscoe to Wurtsboro, from Narrowsburg to Grahamsville, and everywhere in between. And we are asking people now, tell us by August 22nd, there we go, that what you want to do with money in 2025. And if, like I said, if you meet just this little bit of criteria, we are there all the way for you, and we will help you through the administration of the money as well, because we want to follow up and make sure that what we're spending the money on has been used on something really worthwhile.
We have a link to that application on our website, wjffradio.org. You can also find it at sullivanny.us. And eligible applicants include private nonprofit organizations, schools, and municipalities.
Yep.
The other news coming out from you this week is the New York State Child Care Assistance Portal has opened. What's that portal, and how does it help folks?
Mm-hmm. Well, not having a kid, I didn't even know that this existed this way. I didn't realize that we helped directly with paying, or the state helps with paying for child care, which can be super expensive. I've talked to friends I know who have children and have told me how incredibly expensive it is. But for many people, especially what we might call the working poor, the low income, they have to find some sort of child care help if they're to pay any bills within the family whatsoever. And, you know, give them that sense of dignity and pride, too. I mean, so this is a wonderful program to offer to people to help them really over an otherwise insurmountable barrier of child care costs. So the state, recognizing how useful this is, has opened up a new portal that leads into their new ny.gov benefits portal, which has existed for a while. So you'll tell them where you live, give them your zip code, that kind of thing, and then it will have you sign up if you haven't already for ny.gov's portal. And then it will put you in touch with our local social services folks who will review your eligibility. And usually the eligibility thresholds are much more generous than people think they are. So even if you think, well, I'm middle class, not low income, take a look at it, because it may actually be something that could help you even with just a portion of your child care costs. And the information on how to get to that portal, I won't read the web address because it's a little difficult. Yeah.
A lot of letters and dots.
Yes. I mean, it should have just been something like Child Care Portal NY or something, but I wasn't in charge of that part of it. So we do have the link, though, available. We want people to get the help they need. And if you're confused about it, you're like, this is hard for me to go through, give our social services office a call, 845-292-5910. Just hit zero once you get into our phone tree there, and we'll help you over the phone to make sure that you can apply for what you need.
We have a link to the Office of Children and Family Services and that portal at our website as well, wjffradio.org. Just scroll down to the section on the main page that says Community Announcements. Also, the tax foreclosed property repurchase deadline is coming up August 23rd, because that tax auction is then following in September. So that is foreclosed properties that are going to go up for auction.
Yeah. We have tried for years, and this is a testament to our county treasurer, Nancy Buck, and her office, to give people every last opportunity to get their properties back when they've been foreclosed on for taxes. Because for some of them, it is just a momentary fiscal difficulty that unfortunately now has led them not to be able to pay their taxes for several years. And they are, of course, not wanting to be displaced out of their home or lose a property. I mean, not everybody's that way, of course. I get that. And we're not looking to promote bad behavior. But we are looking to not take people's properties unless we absolutely have to, and then only according to the law. Well, the law allows us to have a repurchasing period that lasts right up until basically a month before the auction. We can't go any farther than that, because then we've got to prepare everything for the auction. And there's usually several hundred properties that go up for tax auction every year. But that's down, actually, from, I think, we used to have over 1,000 that would go up. And in part, that's because our treasurer's office works as hard as they can to try to reunite property owners with their tax foreclosed properties. This is not something that they get joy out of doing. what they get joy out of doing is actually accepting that check from somebody who can repurchase their property and is like, okay, it's yours again. But of course, we have to follow the law. So the repurchase deadline is August 23rd. After that, it's going up for tax auction. So obviously you can bid on it in the tax auction, but then it's going to be what it's going to be. And the tax auction will be on September 11th.
And more information about that repurchase deadline and then the auction itself coming up on your website, SullivanNY.
And if you have any questions about it, call the treasurer's office or stop by. They are very friendly, helpful people, even in tough situations like this.
94 days until the general election. You still need election inspectors for local election polling places. How is that going?
It's not going as good as it could be. That's why the legislature recently approved the Board of Elections request for this election only for right now, to raise the per day pay rate for election inspectors from $300 to $400. Because, of course, this is probably going to be the big election for the next, at least 4 years. It's a presidential election. Plus, we may have the staggered terms proposition on there, and we're also going to have some local elections as well. So we need election inspectors. We've got polling sites scattered. I think there's around 60 scattered around the county. Plus, we're going to have early voting that will be, I believe, at the government center and public health again, as they have been in the past. So we need people to be able to step up and commit to even just half a day. Just a few hours as opposed to the full day. It's the full day is 6 a.m. to 9 p.m.
Yeah, it's a long day.
On election day. But then early voting are different hours, and those tend to be less, more like eight-hour shifts on that one. So we're paying, though, for people to not only sit at the tables there and help democracy function, we're going to pay them to take the training, too, $40 per the training, and it's just a partial day training. So we really need a lot of people to sign up for this, as many people as possible. The number is easy to remember, 845-807-0400. That's 807-0400. Give our Board of Elections a call. They will be delighted, let me tell you. They will be relieved to talk to you about it, because we need people all over the county, and we'll work with you on the hours and the location. This is a the seller's market, I think is the phrase for it. So we're looking just for people who are willing to be part of democracy. One thing I do need to mention, though, is you have to be a Sullivan County resident, a U.S. citizen, and either a registered Republican or a registered Democrat.
And if you're listening to us in another county in New York or Pennsylvania, check with your local Board of Elections about their need for election inspectors during the general election as well.
I'm sure they'd be happy to hear from you.
And before we go, a couple of reminders. Jazz artists performing Sunday at the County Museum.
Yeah, this is really cool. I actually updated this press release since I first posted it, because we now have more than one jazz musician, really talented. We had originally posted that we were going to have trumpeter Freddie Jacobs performing this Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. at the County Museum in Hurleyville, along with the band Little Sparrow. He has been a composer, educator, and jazz trumpeter for over 50 years, toured with jazz legends like Lionel Hampton, Buddy Rich, but probably of most interest to people locally, he has experience in our old Borscht Belt hotels. Yeah. And he's going to talk about that, not just play songs. But on top of that, we're also going to have our artist Van Manakis, I think. Manakis, I'm not sure how you say his last name, but he's played before. And the vocalist Ellen Iovino, who are both extraordinary jazz musicians in their own right, they're going to be playing as well. This concert's for free. It's in the County Museum. You get to hear some great tales. There'll probably be refreshments, and you can tour the museum afterwards. I can't think of a better way to spend a Sunday.
And it's inside.
Yes.
Because it's probably going to rain.
It's probably going to rain.
And so
inside with air conditioning.
And the reminder about the humidity and the hot weather, that there are cooling stations throughout the county.
Yeah, we don't have official cooling centers, but we do have actually an interactive map on the county website. And we let people know, listen, your local libraries, the government center. We even tell people, you know, hang out in Walmart. It's actually a very cool place to visit at times. You know, maybe do some shopping. When I was in Cape Cod and it was so hot, I just did a lot of shopping in the stores, or at least browsing. I didn't necessarily buy a lot of things, but we don't have any official cooling centers, mainly because we've never found that people utilize those kinds of things, especially in a county where you can go swimming, or you can find, you're in a car a lot, so you're traveling already in an air conditioning. But if you come across somebody who is in a life-threatening condition, or you feel like you are, do not hesitate to call 911. We will make sure you get the help you need.
Dan Hoost, Sullivan County Government Communications Director, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next Friday.
You too.
Take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak to David Driver about The Stonewall Jukebox, a documentary concert. This is Radio Chatskill.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. This leaves most counties with little or no access to local news and information, and even more are at risk of losing their last local news source. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to this station.
Support the news and information you rely on. Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. Part jubilant musical performance, part little-known oral history. David Driver's The Stonewall Jukebox, a documentary concert, tells the unknown, unexpected, and profoundly uplifting story of how the Stonewall Uprising came to be and how it impacted contemporary LGBTQ plus culture. David Driver will be performing the show at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance Saturday, August 10th at the Tustin Theater in Narrowsburg. And David Driver joins us this morning in the studio with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good.
Now, you performed this down in New York City. You've been working on this. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind the Stonewall Jukebox.
Well, I think what I'd actually first like to say is, because I think a lot of people may not know what Stonewall is. Stonewall is the shortened term for a really important event that happened in June of 1969. It was basically a series of riots that happened at a bar called the Stonewall Inn in Manhattan's Greenwich Village. And for reasons that are explained in this show, it became pretty much the most important cultural shifting point for LGBTQ culture and for our whole culture, really. It's an incredibly important moment, and a lot of people know a little bit about it, but very few people know what really happened and what the crazy, confluence of events was that made it resonate as it did.
Yeah, I think so. I think we sometimes use Stonewall as a shorthand for this point in history that started the international gay rights movement, but it was more than just this one place and day. It was more going on at that time, which you explore here.
Yeah, yeah. It resonated throughout the world, basically. And the reason that we now have Pride time in New York City, for instance, is because that event happened when it happened. Mm-hmm. Pride is always the last weekend in New York, and it's because of the Stonewall Uprising or riots.
You say in website or your press release here that when you were researching this material, you sort of closed your eyes to imagine what the jukebox in that bar would have been like at that time.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that as your inspiration and then the development from there. I mean, we sort of use this shorthand of this place where this movement began, but it was this bar where people went and socialized and had a good time and danced.
Yeah. A crappy bar.
A
dirty, crappy bar that by all accounts served watered down drinks at exorbitant prices.
and may have been run by the mafia, I believe.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Yeah, that is a confirmed fact. And this is, I think the important thing to know about this show is that it's first and foremost an entertainment. It's a big, exciting musical entertainment, because when I go to something, basically, I wanted to make a show that I would want to see. When I go to something, I'm first really interested in the excitement and entertainment of it. And second or third, I'm interested in whatever story they want to tell me. But it's an entertainment that tells a story. So a lot of what we're sort of referring to gets articulated in the show. It was a dive bar, really. It was dirty and dark. It was frequented by a lot of people who basically were not accepted in other bars, even in other gay bars. The sort of fringe element at that time. And our culture has changed a lot. You know, at that time, I think people would be called transvestites. We don't use that term anymore. I think transgender would be the term now. It was a dirty, divey bar that had great music. The truth is, it had two different jukeboxes. There was a front room, which was for the sort of, and keep in mind, this is a young crowd. This is like 30-year-olds. You know, those are the old people at this bar, the 30-year-olds. The front room was more for the sort of staid business types who were wearing suits, you know, Frank Sinatra and Leslie Gore, you know, on that front room jukebox. The back room was like Sly and the Family Stone and Gladys Knight and the Pips and all the exciting dance music, you know. But this show pulls from both of those jukeboxes. And it's important to note that there's a lot of mythology around how the Stonewall Uprising happened. Who was there? Who did what? There's a lot that we just don't know. But one thing we really do know is what was on the jukebox. We have the playlists.
Where did you get the playlist? Was it has that been documented, or how did you research that?
It is. There's an organization called the Stonewall Veterans Foundation, which I don't know when that organization was founded. They have a website. And they're great. I mean, it's so fun to read it. And basically, it was founded by and may still be run by, because I'm sure there are people, you know, living today who were there. Those are the people who kept track of that information. And another, you know, slightly funny thing is that, as many people have said, and this came up in more than one book that I read, if all the people who said they were at Stonewall were actually at Stonewall, like, the island probably would have sunk, because there, you know, there's so many people who claim to have been there, kind of like Woodstock, you know?
Yeah, right. Was there anything from those jukebox playlists that sort of surprised you when you sort of saw that, or was it the fact that the back room had that more kind of dance, cool funk music, and the front room is a little bit more buttoned down?
No, none of it surprised me. I would say it delighted me, because when I looked at the material, a lot of it, and I was simultaneously reading a lot about how the event had come about. In fact, Aaron from One Grand Books had very kindly given me
Aaron Hicklin
a book that he gave me a pre-release copy of a book that is what would you call it, like a compendium of all these different pieces, journalism and magazine listings and articles and interviews. So I started with that book, which was incredibly helpful. But as I read all the different books, wait a minute, I just lost my train of thought.
That's okay. We're asking you about any, like, what delighted by these playlists.
Now I'm back on the train. Okay. So as I was reading the books and simultaneously looking at this playlist, which is about 70 something songs, and listening to them, I was just kind of amazed by how many of them speak to what was happening there and what did happen. You know, how many of the songs lyrically, kind of directly or obliquely address the story that, you know, that we're telling with this. And that was just luck, you know, because one thing I love about this show that I made, one thing that really I think works well about it is that there is this intersection of, like, we're telling this story, but we're doing it through songs, you know, and through little bits of narrative that are intertwined.
Yeah. So that we mentioned in the introduction, it's part musical performance, part oral history.
Yeah.
You've woven this together. You, as I also mentioned, you've been developing this since, what, 2019 commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising.
Yeah. The very first version of it was much more simple and less developed. It was originally commissioned by a place in the city called Symphony Space.
Yep.
And they had coordinated with a bunch of other arts organizations to do 50th anniversary celebrations. And so they came to me, and that's how we landed on this. But the first version was, it was good. I liked it. But this one, I've had much more time to basically develop the idea.
So, and you developed it here. You brought it from New York City up to the Sullivan Catskills and have been working on it. And so how have you expanded this then in from the sort of more compact version of it that you debuted a few years ago?
I would say that I have fleshed it out in terms of the information that's being given. And I've also pared it down in a certain way because it's not something that I do that often, to be honest, reading, you know, a huge amount of material and pulling from that material what seemed to me to be the key points of how this happened and, you know, what are the key story points and what are the crazy things that happened. Basically, I started out with a script that probably would have taken 8 hours. And then over the course of time, I whittled it down and down and down to the point where it was really just, to me, the most, you know, pared down and clear telling of the story. And, you know, and then figured out how to weave that into the songs, you know, because the last thing that I want is to see someone, it's not a speech. It's not a, you know, whatever like that. I would not want to watch someone talking for 15 minutes about what happened, you know.
Right. Like a history lesson.
It's got a lot of information, but set in the context of this incredible music from that era and also played by a band that I feel really lucky to have. Like, mostly Broadway players are doing this. People that I've worked with before, and our music director, Ann Klein, has worked with. She's done a bunch of Broadway stuff. And I was like, come to Narrowsburg. It's awesome. So there, you know, it's a bunch of people from the city and then some local artists as well.
We're talking to David Driver about The Stonewall Jukebox, a documentary concert telling the unknown, unexpected, and uplifting story of the Stonewall Uprising. It's coming to the DVAA's Tustin Theater on August 10th. That's next Saturday in Narrowsburg. You are a musician, and you talk about the band. Tell us a little bit more about the band. And also, you have guest singers and narrators coming into this, too. So it's got this kind of revolving cast in a way that kind of keeps it fresh and fun.
Yeah, I would say it's, you know, I love the Tustin Theater. I've done things there before. I think it's a beautiful little, you know, it's not a big space, but it's such a cool space. You know, I think that theater was originally built as a movie house, and you can still see the movie posters out in the lobby. The scale of the show, when we did it a few weeks ago on the actual anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, which was June 28th. We did it at a place in New York City called City Winery, which is big. And, you know, another really cool venue, very different. That was a cast and crew of 24 people, which is a lot. We have now pared it down to about 12. So this show is about 12 people. We still have the incredible band augmented by some local musicians who I really like and have worked with before. A guy named David Christian is going to do the show.
We know him.
Yep. David Christian is awesome. Ann Klein, as I said, is the musical director. Jeremy Chatsky, who's a local resident, is going to play bass. Very skilled bass player who has, you know, toured with a lot of people. Ronnie Spector, Bruce Springsteen. Actually, we have two Bruce Springsteen people because Everett Bradley, who is playing percussion and singing, uh-huh. Also, he's a member of John Bon Jovi's band, but he also has toured with The Boss.
Some folks with some serious chops there.
Yes. Yeah. He's a serious, they're all quite good.
And the narrators, you've got some local figures of known figures here.
We've got my beloved friend Mimi McGurl, who when I called her, you know, because Mimi, you know Mimi, right?
Yeah.
Mimi's so great. When I called her and asked her to do this, she was like, "Yeah, let's meet up and we'll talk through the script." And I was like, "Mimi, I'm not asking you to be a dramaturg. I'm asking you to be a narrator." So Mimi McGirl is narrating it, and then a guy named Julian Jimenez.
Yes.
Who is, he, in fact, I think he received a grant from DVAA to do his work. He's a playwright.
We talked to him here, too. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
And a fun fact, Tustin Theater was not only a film house in the 1930s, but prior to that, a former firehouse and community center. So, yes.
Oh, wow. It's before it was a movie house?
Yeah, a former firehouse community center. It was transformed into a film house in the 30s, and then it closed permanently in the 80s. But then Sullivan County, Town of Tustin, and DVAA renovated it in 1990 and has presented the programs there every season since.
Wow.
So, yeah, we've got a nice little history there.
I mean, I know there's a poster for the movie Cabaret, in the, and it's not like the movie poster. It's one of those ones that is, like, offset printed, you know? a lot of movies that I've never heard of in there as well.
We talked about how you don't want this to be a history lesson, but what do you want folks to take from this event that you're doing next Saturday?
First of all, I want them to feel joyful and uplifted, because it is incredibly joyful and uplifting music. And second of all, I'd like to shed some light on what is really a fascinating and important moment in our culture. And just know a bit more. Even, you know, people who it was funny when we did the show in the city, I had some people as guest performers, and I sent the basically the final version of the script out, and some of them were reaching out to me and basically giving me notes on the script, which was like, okay, well, you're not the writer, but okay. But the funny thing was, I was fine with it, because I really like collaborating in that way. But some of them were kind of correcting me on things that are essentially mythology. You know, there's a great belief that a particular person named Storme, I can't remember, a woman who performed as a man and in her personal life went as a woman, but in her professional life was addressed as a man. There is a great belief that she was the sort of first spark. And in fact, that's not true. I mean, she may have been there or may not have been there, but a lot of people believe that. And I had to kind of gently correct a number of people on that, because, you know, I did a lot of research, so yeah. I actually know what the facts around it are.
You can see that research in full display August 10th, Saturday, at the Tustin Theater in Narrowsburg.
A week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow. It's the Stonewall Jukebox, a documentary concert, and there's more information and ticket information at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. And we've been talking to David Driver, the creator of it. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for bringing this up to the Tustin.
Tim, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, Enchanted World art exhibit coming to Jeffersonville tomorrow. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi has more after this.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl, and the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Radio Chatskill. Maya McLaughlin is an artist whose works are full of magic, imagination, and whimsy. Her new exhibit of contemporary pen and watercolor works, Enchanted World, opens tomorrow at Ratty Books in Jeffersonville. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi has more.
Welcome, Maya, to Radio Chatskill.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you have an event coming up this week at Saturday the 3rd. And it's an opening of an exhibit, and it's from 10 to 11:30 at Ratty Books in Jeffersonville. And it is entitled Enchanted World. Can you tell us about the exhibit and the work that'll be displayed in it?
Of course. So my upcoming exhibit at Ratty Books is it's a collection of whimsical, fantastical, dreamlike influenced watercolor paintings. They're all miniature. And it's kind of an exploration of the magical, the imaginative, crazy landscapes, unrealistic colors, creatures, all that things that lets the viewer, I invite the viewer to step into another realm, maybe a parallel universe, something a little bit unusual and funky, weird anthropomorphic animals and orange skies, things like that. So it's a little bit of an exploration of something magical.
And what is the medium?
So I'm working in watercolor. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually really, really happy with the colors I use. They're all handmade in Italy, in Assisi, by an artist who uses only natural pigments. So it's all real pigments from stones, from flowers, plants, precious, semi-precious stones from all over the world.
Wonderful.
And they're bound together by honey from Tuscany. And every single color is just from start to finish made by hand, which I really love and appreciate. And I also use, the paper that I use is a cotton paper made in Italy as well from Fabriani, which is the oldest paper maker in the world. And it's actually the same paper that Michelangelo and Beethoven and Giorgio O'Keeffe used as well. And it's pretty much almost an unchanged formula since 1264.
Whoa, well, that's quite a history there.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And how long is the exhibit on for?
It'll be on from August 3rd to September 30th.
Good.
So it'll be there for a while until it's all sold out, whatever comes first. it'll be open. It'll be up for some time. So even if you can't make it on the 3rd, it'll be there for you to enjoy even after that.
And is there anything special happening on the 3rd there during the exhibit opening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have we've had some very, very awesome sponsors all across Jeff. All of Main Street feels like it got involved. So we have meats and cheeses from Sullivan Sundries and coffee from Bloom. Terra Space is serving some rosé bubbly, and Spindrift is also going to be there. We have healthy snacks for kids, lots of vegetables and fruits. So we have, you know, things to snack on and mosey around, look at the paintings and chat. I'll be there to talk about them a little bit. And we're also going to do a little story time, classic for Ratty Books. Every Saturday morning is story time. So I'm also going to read a book for the kids that are going to be there. So it'll just be a nice Saturday morning with some snacks and drinks to hang out in town.
And it's a family event.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very kid-forward, very kid-friendly, kid-inspired. and Ratty Books, we love having families come as a unit anyway. So kids are very much welcome. I'm trying to encourage families and especially children to feel an interest in art early on.
Yes.
I was fortunate enough myself to grow up in an artist family and basically spend my childhood in galleries and museums. And I really loved that, and I really appreciated that. So I really want kids to feel included, and not that it's something that they're not supposed to be there, it's not for them, but this is specifically with children and whimsy and their beautiful spirit in mind, just creating freely without restrictions. So, and the snacks are going to be healthy for kids too.
Wonderful.
And it's Saturday morning, so.
And that's from 10 to 11:30. And
exactly.
It's the opening of Enchanted World, a watercolor exhibit. Thank you so much, Maya, for taking the time to share this. And thank you to Ratty Books for having this wonderful store on Main Street for kids of all ages.
Absolutely. We love Ratty Books. Happiest time.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Mancy. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Reminder to sign up for One Small Step, our initiative with StoryCorps, pairing folks of different backgrounds together. Go to wjffradio.org to learn more. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Chatskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. livingstonmanorny.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturdays at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill for stories about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Feed your ears some good radio produce. Listen local.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, thunderstorm or two mixed with sun and clouds, humid, high of 81. Thunderstorms sticking around through the weekend. Tonight, possibility of thunderstorms, low 68. Also, a heavier thunderstorm on Saturday and Sunday, 83, the high both days. On Points next. It's 11 o'clock.